Alrighty. Peter, you gonna be making a presentation for us here?
Yes, sir, ready to get started?
The Open Public Meetings Act and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Okay, great, well, let's get started.
Okay. So this is part of a training that is required by law. We have an open government training. It is inclusive of two main elements. And includes both public records and open public meetings. We have quite a bit of material to cover. I would encourage you all to pose a question. It might break things up a little bit, because otherwise I'm going to be rambling a little bit. Try not to be rambling, but. So within 90 days of taking oath of office, elected officials are required to take this training. I know you all actually had this training, I think, about a year ago, but so this is a refresher, so this will extend your time because it has to happen every 4 years as well. There are also training resources that are available if there's any sort of need to brush up on anything. Those are available on the Attorney General website. You can see that cited in the materials. We're dealing with two different statutes, the Public Records Act and the Open Public Meetings Act. I would say that we do have some materials at the end that we can go through, and it's ethics type materials, conflict of interest issues, if we have time. So the Public Records Act, you have the citation there, and we start with the basic premise: what is a public record? You know, as lawyers, we like to break everything down into its minutiae. Any writing containing information. So these are all separate elements, arguably, to a public record. Containing information relating to the conduct of government, the performance of any governmental or proprietary function. We emphasize prepared, owned, used, or retained by the city, regardless of its physical form or characteristics. So when we talk about prepared, owned, or used or retained, sometimes we get into issues with third-party contractors. There's case law on that. I would just take a step back here. Public records. So I've been doing public records work since 2003. And I'm amazed over the course of time how many cases have come down on public records. So we get our updates of appellate cases, Supreme Court cases, appellate court cases. And in almost every batch that we get, I wouldn't say maybe almost every, but a large percentage have a Public Records Act case, because there's been so much litigation over this over those years, and it's accelerated over time. As you might expect, there are people that have, or you may or may not expect, there are people that have a cottage industry of trying to catch local jurisdictions in Public Records Act mishaps or failures or mistakes. And we'll get to this later, but there are substantial penalties that can go along with these mistakes. And there are a lot of people that are very aware of this law. And there are good faith efforts to try to get records from agencies that don't go well, and that they can end up in litigation. Continuing on this theme of it being very broad, it's defined to include, and this is an old definition, but it's still quite broad, handwriting, typewriting, et cetera, and every other means of recording any form of communication. And so even though this definition includes some things that sound a little bit out of date, like punched cards, magnetic or punched cards, it's written sufficiently broadly, and the courts have interpreted it to include, obviously, audio files, various types of data, and I'm not a big IT guy, but you just go down the list, and if it's recorded, it's going to be a public record. 911 tapes, even a voicemail message. If it's recorded and there's a request made while a voicemail message is responsive to that request, it should be provided. It does present some challenges for how do you actually go about capturing all those, retaining those, and then searching those. But I want to emphasize how broadly it is written. Continuing on with that theme, the records can include those stored on home computers, personal computers, laptops, non-agency email accounts. So the practice tip there is to use your city email account. And I don't know exactly how the city of Blaine configures your work, but the key is stay off your personal phone and stay off your personal computer. What has happened, and this has been litigated, is if there's any sense that a record that's responsive could be on an employee or an elected official's computer, what our office does and what many offices for legal counsel around the state has to do per the law is to basically get an affidavit from the elected official or the employee saying, yep, I've used these search terms and I've produced everything, or there's nothing on my computer, if there's any sense that a responsive record could be on an individual's personal computer. And that reference to there, it says, while it's less important in the Nissen case. So in that case, if I remember correctly, someone was going after an elected official, I believe, or at least an employee. I can't remember which one it was. They were going after
law enforcement. I think it was the
police chief, maybe?
It was the police chief.
Yeah, and so they were going after they wanted to examine that individual's computer. They, being the plaintiffs, wanted the court to order that. And the court kind of landed on this middle ground that allowed for this affidavit process that I'm referring to, basically saying that if you get that affidavit and you don't have any contrary information, then that's sufficient to satisfy the request. And the court recognized that there's some expectation of privacy, but again, it's not a guarantee that you're not going to get a forensic review in all circumstances.
But for the most part, it's a de facto honor system, isn't it?
You mean in reality?
Yeah, in practice, it seems like a bit of an honor system. If someone, I solemnly swear that I checked my whole computer and couldn't find anything that was covered under the inquiry.
Right, but then the other thing to keep in mind is the honor system can be undermined. So let's say an individual out there, because again, all this is on the internet. Let's say someone says, well, here, I have this, I have this email from an individual's personal email account, and they said over here in this affidavit that they produced everything. Well, I know for a fact that that's not the case, and so now you're going to potentially be facing a forensic examination of your home computer. So there's an element of honor system, but there's also risk involved if we're not diligent and really thinking through that and doing the full search. So I don't recall the year, but in the last probably 10 years, there was quite an overhaul to the Public Records Act, and there were lots of regulations that were passed basically requiring public agencies to take certain actions, such as appoint a public records officer. That's done with the City of Blaine. I think that's Mr. Crawford. Okay, so you have your public records officer. He's probably gone to more trainings than I have or given on this, and so which is part of the requirement, and you're to adopt rules and procedures, which I understand the City of Blaine has those, that covers those elements, provide full access to public records, protects the records from damage or destruction, prevent excessive interference with other agency functions. So they're trying to balance it out a little bit. They recognize that these can be onerous, and so you want to have your processes in place such that you're not just bringing city staff to a grinding halt as they search for records and have to respond to all these requests. One thing that we actually refer to as kind of a guiding light here is that second to last bullet point, provide full assistance to requesters. And so that's something to fall back on whenever you find yourself, you might be annoyed with a requester. You might feel like it's been overly burdensome, but if you come back to some of these themes, it's going to put the city in a good position, and that is to continue to have that in mind, provide full assistance to requesters. And timely action is also important, and we'll get into some of the real specifics of what those timelines are. So there are some requirements for a public records request, but I would say that they are minimal in a way. It has to be identifiable public records. So the opposite of an identifiable public record is a request for information. A request for information is not a request for records. For example, I want to know, you know, how many employees work in the Public Works Department. Please tell me that. Well, that's a request for information. And if it were changed slightly, it would be a request for public records. It would be, you know, give me the payroll and the list of employees working for Public Works. But you do get folks that make requests for information, and the agency is not required to create, the city is not required to create a record. Now, there might be some circumstances where you have a records request that you look at it and you're like, okay, yeah, that's a request for identifiable public records. But if we were to create a document, and it would take me a couple keystrokes and I could produce that document, there could be times, and I have run across situations where you're better off creating a document, because then the requester's like, oh yeah, I'm good with that information, and I'm going to release the city from having to spend months and months gathering this information. The requester, you can't require them to use the agency's form, and they can ask to actually inspect the records, or they can get copies of them.
Where does the line for sensitive information end? So you mentioned the payroll for people, which is public record. Everybody should be able to get that. That's fine. Can a citizen say, I want to know the home addresses of everybody who works at City of Blaine?
I believe home addresses are fall within an exemption.
Okay.
And there are numerous exemptions, and we might talk about some of those, but it might be 100, I can't remember how many, but there's some very, very specialized exemptions.
I think there's close to 300.
Okay, so there's close to 300, and some of those the city of Blaine will never deal with. And we'll talk a little bit more about exemptions, but there are some privacy exemptions. And in addition to some exemptions, there's some new processes in the last few years that are in place for having to give notice to an employee when, for example, part of their personnel file is about to be disclosed for some reason. So there are exemptions for excluding some things, and then there are processes for providing notice when even the city looks at it and says, okay, yeah, this is excluded, or this is exempt from public records production, but we're going to have to provide this other document. And then the city would have to give notice to the employee would allow them, if they so chose, to go get an injunction stopping the city from producing the record. As I mentioned, timelines are important, and all public records officers are very, and a lot of city staff are also very cognizant of the 5 business day response deadline. And within that time, the agency will have to do one of several things: acknowledge receipt of the request and provide a reasonable estimate for when further response is going to be provided. Just fulfill the request. You know, sometimes that's the easiest thing to do. Oh, you want this record, here it is. Or it's on the city's website at such and such a place. That's number three. Sometimes it is worth seeking clarification. Again, if you can both meet the requester's intent and save the city some staff time, you might seek clarification, or it may just be an unclear request. That happens as well. That's one of the options. Or deny the request, but there has to be a written statement of the specific reasons for denial. And we'll get more into when you're setting an exemption, you have to provide an exemption log with certain elements of information when you're responding to a request and you're claiming an exemption. One of the biggest things that a public records officer has to think about is, how am I going to design my search? So, you know, you have this request, you're kind of thinking through, okay, where might all these records be? And so this provides an outline of how to go about doing that to satisfy the law. You might need to clarify the request. determine how to collect responsive records. You might be looking in paper files if you think that they're not on the electronic form. Consider all the different formats. Consider the different individuals or departments that might be the repository of those documents. And then, you know, and this gets especially tricky when you're going into older records where you have to look into, you know, the paper files, archives, audio files. And the law requires what's noted there is an adequate search. So that's what the court's going to be looking at for whether you've complied with the law on the extent and the reasonableness of your search. And I guess a further legal definition has to be reasonably calculated to uncover responsive records. And you must follow obvious leads to possible locations. So if it's something that is focused on the police department, that's going to be a focus, but there might be an obvious lead where, yeah, no, we're going to have to look at the police department and finance, for example. The finance office there might be some overlap there. So that's a big job and a big part of the public records officer's job is to really define how they're going to go about getting those records. Or city council. Well, we know that's a big city council issue. We're going to have to get into, and I assume you all have sort of you have your email, you have your laptop, but I assume mostly for city council, it's email messages, I would imagine, because most of your documents are online in city council records. And a practice tip, not so much for the council, but for staff, is to really document your search efforts, because you want to be able to show a court, yes, not only are you saying that we conducted an adequate search, but here are all the steps that we followed so that you can make that showing to the court. Exemptions, we talked about those a little bit. And exemptions are going to be read narrowly, they're narrowly construed. So everything in the act is intended to satisfy this open government concept. The documents are presumed to be open. The exemptions are narrowly construed. What does that mean? Well, if we have a close call, the court's going to say, I'm going to err on the side of this not falling within an exemption. It has to be produced. The city is going to have to justify the exemption. And as I mentioned earlier, when you are saying, nope, this is protected under this privacy provision, or it's an ongoing investigation, you have to specify the date of the record, the type of it, the type of the record, the author, the number of pages withheld, and then a citation to the statute that provides the exemption with a brief description of how it falls within that exemption. Notable exemptions. So this slide up until this weekend was entitled Common Exemptions. And the reason I made it notable is because the last bullet point, we'll talk about that one. But common exemptions include the attorney-client privilege. So, you know, we try to include in our email messages a reference to this being potentially attorney-client privilege, because then when a public records officer is looking at it, they say, they stop. Now, that doesn't mean for sure that it's going to be protected. Keep that in mind. So sometimes staff or elected officials can get in the habit of saying, you know, I'm just going to copy the city attorney or legal counsel, because then it's going to be protected. Well, that's not the case. In order for it to be attorney-client privilege, it has to be for the purpose of receiving legal advice. So it might be the sharing of information with the attorney, or it might be the attorney actually providing legal advice. But a lot of these things may not be protected by attorney-client privilege, just because we have that plaster, you know, might end up being plastered at the top. So keep in mind, just because a document is labeled as such doesn't mean it's going to be privileged, but it's a good flag for everyone involved to say, we got to treat this confidentially. And I'll make a side note on that. One reason, for example, we don't want city government providing the attorney-client privilege materials outside of the, you know, city staff and the city council, is because you can destroy attorney-client privilege by sharing it with a third party. And so that's just it's kind of a little bit of a deeper dive on attorney-client privilege.
Well, if you want to think about it, some people put, like, you know, Think twice before you print this email for recycling, or recycle if you do. And I may not have a return. Say.
Yeah, that's a good point. I appreciate that. protected health information that can be because of the ADA may require the employer to keep files separately that have to do with employee health issues. Pending investigative records. This is a common theme. A lot of times the police will be, especially law enforcement, will be not, they will not be providing information that has to do with an ongoing investigation if it could affect the effectiveness of law enforcement. As we talked about certain information in personnel files. And then we have the deliberative process exemption. And arguably this has taken up too much bandwidth on this slide because this is a tricky one. You get folks wanting, isn't this part of the deliberative process? Well, what I always say is if you're going to have to produce it eventually, then there's got to be a good reason to not produce it now. And the deliberative process exemption is problematic because it only works until the decision is made. So if someone's remembering that, it's like, okay, well, now I want all the documents related to your discussion about X, Y, and Z. And so
I want to have some questions about this one. So if four members of council wind up in the same place at the same time, they can talk about the weather, but as soon as they start talking about we really need to replace the sidewalks in that block, then all of a sudden they're talking about something that could be an action item. And the big distinguishing thing is that no action item should happen without a properly noticed public meeting. So when you're talking about the deliberative process, if there's a communication of we're probably going to have to redo some of the sidewalks, but there hasn't been four council members saying yes, let's go ahead and order that work. So where is the line in the sand here on what's a protected deliberative process or what is subject to a recovered, you know, a public meetings request?
Well, I would say that this is probably more of a staff-oriented exemption to begin with. Seldom can I see council generating. Now there might be documents that, for example, an executive session that are protected by attorney-client privilege that you wouldn't produce, but seldom would council be involved in that, and that's. Because you kind of hinted at maybe some email exchanges. Now, those you're going to be watching out. We're going to get into that with the Open Public Meetings Act. But I can't think of a good example where council documents would be protected by the deliberative process. But let's say you had staff that are really trying to formulate something that they're going to bring to council. And they're not sure, but the law is kind of recognizing, look, if you're in the middle of creating a draft report to council on recommending some kind of infrastructure project, then, and someone asks for that document, maybe it's a long process, maybe it's a couple month process. The staff could say, you know what, this is still in draft form. We're still deliberating on what we're going to recommend to council. And so we're going to cite the deliberative process exemption. But now I would say, first of all, that's going to be provided eventually. And the other thing is the only thing you can withhold in that context are actual opinions. So what you would be producing is a draft report and you'd be crossing out all of the opinions because the facts would have to be provided. And so it ends up being such a strange process and people kind of raise their eyebrows. That, I mean, there could be an example where it's valuable and it's used, but I think it has some real problems to it because eventually that staff report is going to go to council. So that's my experience with it anyway.
Well, that was clear as mud.
Well, yeah, again, so the elements are it's draft, no decision's been made, and it's the opinions and not the facts. Facts have to be provided if it's cited in a report. And there's not a lot of good, strong case law on it. for the staff to, you know, for staff and legal counsel to stand on when using this exemption. So, as I mentioned, there's been a lot of litigation over Public Records Act violations. It turns out most claims are successful, and they're not covered by insurance. So the penalties that come with it and the attorney's fees that an agency has to pay, the other side's attorney's fees, you can't get insurance to cover that. The penalties can be up to $100 per day per record withheld. Already talked about the attorney's fees. It doesn't work both ways. The city doesn't get its attorney's fees if it's successful in the litigation, but the other side does. And they continue to, these penalties and fees accrue through each level of appeal. So let's say you're successful at the trial court level, but the plaintiff appeals and is successful at the appellate court level. And I'm not familiar with this, but I haven't seen it directly, but apparently some of these cases are accepted on a contingency basis by these folks that I was referring to, where the attorney will say, "Hey, I think you got a good case. If I get a third, we'll sue the city on a Public Records Act violation." So we're going to talk about mitigating factors and aggravating factors. So this is what the court's going to be looking at as to whether the penalty is going to be reduced or go up. Lack of clarity in the request can help the city in this context. If the city responds promptly, that'll be a mitigating factor. Good faith, honest and timely, and at least attempted strict compliance with the procedural requirements. If we've had proper training, which is why it's good we're doing this, good training and good supervision. The reasonableness of any explanation for non-compliance by the agency, that can be a lot of different things. Has the agency been at least attempted to be helpful to the requester? And does the agency have systems to track requests and retrieve public documents? Aggravating factors, which can increase the penalty. A delayed response, so it's basically the opposite of a lot of what we talked about, a lack of strict compliance with process, a lack of training, an unreasonable explanation for why there wasn't compliance, and all those horrible things at the bottom for, you know, why the agency wasn't able to comply with the request. And these are all set out in the case law.
I really like how unreasonable and obvious are words that are in here, because those just only have one possible meaning. And
right. Yeah. Well, notice how, you know, as it was, you know, everything is stacked against the agency. You know, the mitigating factors is a list that takes up one slide, and of course the aggravating factors is double that. I won't read all those to you, but you have those in the packet, in the materials. Okay, before we leave public records, are there any questions on that?
I just wanted to say, because like I feel responsible, like going through this crap, that Richard's question, although maybe in your lawyer mind you might have thought your answer to, none of us understood what you're talking about. I think he said that.
I wouldn't say that.
Okay. I think, and then because after everything transpired, I thought to myself, well, in his scenario, you've got four folks who are sitting down at the beer garden at, you know, something during the summer downtown. And so it just so happens that the four people congregate there and they start talking about something. And then somebody hears them talking, makes a public records request to Sam about that conversation that's happening. That's not a written record. A, it's opinions. B, it's hearsay. C, right?
I wouldn't even get to the opinions and hearsay. It's not a written record. Yeah, sorry, I didn't miss that. Yeah.
So right. I mean, that's okay. That's all I wanted to say. Sorry. I just thought we should be responsible public agents and address that more fully.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Yeah, so, and that really gets into the issue of a request for information as opposed to a request for a record.
Right. And it wasn't written, it's like.
Right.
One thing that would be helpful for me to understand is about document retention, what municipal requirements there are regarding our retention obligations versus, so obviously there are transitory records and documents versus ones that have retention value. And I know what the state's requirements are, I know what my agency's requirements are, what my client's obligations are, but I don't know what my personal obligations are in terms of emails. I'm assuming if it's transitory, I'm okay deleting that, but I tend to err on the side of retaining things because I tend to be fairly conservative. But it would be helpful to know if there is a retention schedule, where would I find it, and how would I, with all these emails that keep accumulating in my Outlook, what, you know, how do I prioritize as, you know, year one, year two, year three, year four goes by, when I can delete something and when I need to save it based on like the contents.
Are we not supposed to be deleting that stuff? Because I'm deleting the hell out of my inbox.
It doesn't really delete.
Yeah, go ahead.
So in terms of your emails, if you delete every single email from here on out, that's really fine, simply because we have a server that retains every single email that's sent by council and staff. So you can delete all you want. I'll still find it.
That's what he's saying.
So we do that process for you with retention schedules and for email searches.
How long is that retention schedule?
So it depends on each and every email and the content of each one. However, we have it programmed to be a rolling 10 years, simply because there are some projects that require 10 years. And we just kind of have that benchmark just in case.
And I haven't looked at it specifically for a city council for a code city, but elected officials, a lot of times there may be some that are subject to destruction at a certain point based on the retention schedule. So the retention schedule, much like the exemption list, is voluminous, the state retention schedule for local governments. But my memory is, and this is, that for elected officials, the retention schedule is very long. So
you can file with the Secretary of State the same way that state agencies do? State
archives?
No, the retention schedules for state agencies have to be filed with the Secretary of State's office. And they're all centrally on the Secretary of State's website. So I wasn't sure if municipalities had their schedules similarly filed.
The state promulgates a retention schedule, basically lays it down for local governments. It's all specified. It's not like the city can come up with its own retention schedule.
Thank you. That's helpful.
But your delete button is an illusion on our city email. Sam's got it all forever.
Clearly.
I just want to add that, remember with the actual public records request, that a person does not have to give a name. So you could simply just email from an email address, for example, Mr. Good Citizen, and you have to be responsive to that request. It does not require a name.
And from the standpoint of, if we were to receive a request for documents as city council members, is it appropriate for us to treat that as a public records request and forward that to Sam?
Yes.
Okay.
How do you want that handled, Sam?
Yeah, I would appreciate you repeating the question for me.
Yeah.
My question was, if a citizen were to ask us for city records or documents, would it be appropriate for us to forward that to you as the public records officer for processing?
100%.
Okay.
Yeah, my office does all the public records request processing. So yes, please send them all to me.
Thank you.
Okay, should we move on to open public meetings? All right. So, you know, lofty purposes stated up front, but I will say that in cases involving open government and open public meetings, these clauses get cited. So they're not just something, you know, that people put at the beginning of the, you know, the statute. I mean, they are at the beginning of the statute, but they're also something that courts cite. So just as we talked about, public records are basically the act is read to tend to produce and read exemptions narrowly. The open government, the Open Public Meetings Act is read to be interpreted along the lines of the public does not give public servants the right to decide what is good for the people, to know what is not good for them to know. The people insist on remaining informed so they can remain in control over the instruments they have created. Okay, so the OPMA applies to any time a quorum of elected officials meet to discuss agency business, whether or not they're in the same room. So that immediately gets us into telephone conferences, video conferences, or email exchanges. And we'll talk more about email exchanges, text exchanges, because we get into that issue of a serial meeting. We've talked about it before, but I can tell you that jurisdictions fall into the trap because texting and emailing has become, you know, in society just so immediate, and people want to have that immediate interaction and deliberation. So there's a big temptation, but it can create a real problem under open public meetings. We have different numbers of quorum. You know what a quorum is under Robert's rules. We have different numbers on there because you could have a 3-person committee or a 5-person committee. Certain committees of the council by law will be considered subject to the OPMA. But I believe that the way that the city of Blaine handles it, and it's handled by a lot of jurisdictions, is you have in your council rules of procedure that basically every board and commission is going to be subject to the OPMA. And that's a good practice because you never know when you're going to trigger one of the aspects of when a committee or a board becomes subject to the OPMA. So it's a precautionary measure, and the public likes it, and it's a good practice. So the OPMA does not apply to social gatherings at which a quorum may be present as long as no business of the city is conducted. And we'll talk more about what business or action is, but an awards banquet, attendance at a seminar where you're just receiving information, you're not engaging in a discussion of city business. And another thing that falls outside of the OPMA are discussions about labor negotiations and strategies. Now, you will probably have listed on your agenda on occasion executive session labor negotiations or labor negotiation strategy. Well, it turns out that that's kind of a misnomer. It's fine to put it on the agenda that way, but the reality is it's not subject to the OPMA. There's no executive session that's allowed for labor negotiations because it's just outside of the act altogether. The fundamental language, all meetings of the governing body shall remain open, and persons may be able to attend the meeting, and this is gavel to gavel. We have the gavel image there, and basically from the beginning to the end, we know there are some exceptions, and those are executive sessions. Okay, what is a governing body? It's a city council or any committee of such public agency. When the committee acts on behalf of the governing body, which the cases have said that, and this is kind of legal speak, exercises actual or de facto decision-making authority, or takes testimony or public comment. So this is one reason, the second bullet point, where we say, you know, you have a board or commission, make it subject to the OPMA, because if they invite someone in to give some testimony, they've triggered the OPMA. So we don't worry too much about whether they exercise actual or de facto decision-making, we just make them subject to the OPMA. How are we doing on time, Sam? We're
doing good. We have about 35 or so minutes left. My math is off, about 40 or so minutes left.
Okay. What is a meeting? And I think this is important. It's any time that a quorum takes action. Physical presence is not required. We've talked about an email exchange could constitute a meeting. For example, if a quorum of members engage in an email exchange, it could be a text exchange. And I will say right now that you're better off just not engaging. I would say don't engage other city council members by text or email, because you never know when that discussion, that thread gets forwarded to a quorum. So you can easily trigger an OPMA violation with emails or texting.
I think we need more clarification on this. So we can, if we are vigilant, have up to to 3 council members on an email, as long as it's not forwarded or added or shared up one notch, as long as it remains contained and we're vigilant about that, we can certainly have 2 or 3 council members in an email exchange. My understanding of something that occasionally goes wrong is when someone emails the entire council and then one council member reply all with a comment, then you're in jeopardy, because then individual council members could all keep replying all, and it's the entire council on the email thread.
And what I've seen is this: what's remaining vigilant and having certainty are two different things. So I can be very vigilant. I'm just emailing these other 2 council members, council member X and council member Y. Council member Y says, you know, that's an interesting point. I'm going to see what these other council members think about this discussion. And they forward it and they try to get some feedback. And so it's very risky, in my opinion. Now, what in other jurisdictions I've seen council members say, here's what I want to talk about in relation to this subject at a future meeting. And they put it out there and it ends there. I mean, I've seen that, and that's passive receipt of information. If you're confident that no one's going to, further that email exchange, that's not prohibited. But I think the best advice is just stay away from any sort of group texting or email other than a very formal, like, this is going to be a topic of future discussion, period, without any exchange whatsoever. Because, and I think it might be in the next slide, action is misleading, okay? Action sounds like final action, but action includes deliberations, discussions, considerations, reviews, evaluations, and receipt of public testimony. So a discussion, so in the example that was raised earlier about meeting somewhere, 4 council members meeting somewhere and talking about the sidewalk, that's action. And it didn't sound like it occurred at a public meeting, so it's an OPMA violation. And same is true if it happens by texting or emailing or in any form whatsoever. Final action is a collective position or negative decision or an actual vote by a majority of the governing body or by a committee thereof. And these must be taken in public, even if deliberations are in closed session. So you are never going to have a vote or a decision in executive session. We can have direction provided in executive session, which is a sense that your attorney or your labor negotiator will get. Of course, in the negotiations context, you have more freedom because it's not covered by the OPMA. But you can derive direction from a council discussion. It's not a decision, it's just general direction. Secret ballots are not allowed. So one thing I've seen an agency try to do is like, okay, we're going to appoint a council member to fill a vacancy. You have your interviews in public. The interview has to be in public. The evaluation occurs behind closed doors. And then you come out and no one wants to be offending anyone. So they say, just write your name and pass it to the mayor, and the mayor is going to count the votes. Well, you've just violated the OPMA, because that's arguably a secret ballot, because no one can see who's voting and how. We have a distinction between regular meetings and special meetings. Regular meetings are those that at the beginning of the year, you either pass a resolution or you have it established in your council rules of procedures or your bylaws as to when those meetings will occur. I'm not going to bore you with all the notice requirements. Mr. Crawford and everyone does a really good job of getting the agenda out. You have to get the agenda out within 24 hours. However, you can still take final action on items that are not on the agenda. You can modify the agenda. And the law does not invalidate otherwise legal action taken at a regular meeting where an agenda was not posted 24 hours in advance. Special meetings, they do occur. They can be called by the presiding officer or majority of the members. And I think your Blaine Council Rules of Procedure follow that. You have to provide notice of the meeting at least 24 hours in advance, given to each member, published in a local newspaper, general circulation, where there's a request on file and prominently displayed at the main entrance. And the thing about special meetings, and that might be on the next slide, is this is where final action does become important. So these are all the elements of what has to be in the notice. Final disposition cannot be taken on any matter not listed on the agenda, but other matters can be discussed. So what that means is like, okay, you scramble, you need to get an emergency approval of a bid, and then someone else comes in and says, hey, we want to add this to the agenda. Well, you can add it for discussion, but you can't take final action on it unless it was on that original notice for a special meeting. Again, regular meeting, you could go ahead and take up any matter. I mean, sometimes there's public hearing requirements that wouldn't let you do that, but in terms of the OPMA, you can add items to the agenda and take final action. There are provisions for special meetings in the context of an emergency. And this is actually, there's been a change in the law with respect to public attendance, public comment, just within the last year. Previously, this slide said, you don't have to have a public comment period. Well, under the new law, you have to have an opportunity for public comment whenever final action is taken at a meeting. The public comment does not have to be a public comment period. You can allow for a written public comment period with a deadline before the meeting, but most agencies, what I've been advising them is, you know, special meeting, you're going to take final action. A lot of times in the past, jurisdictions didn't have public comment during a special meeting, and I'm saying have a public comment period if you're going to take final action, because the law requires it now. And you can't impose conditions on the public to attend meetings, you know, making them, you know, register their names or address or complete a questionnaire or anything of that
nature. Can you tell me how that fits in with the fact that we put a little sign-up sheet for when people want to, so, and we, when they come to the microphone, we say, please say, give your name and your address for the record. How does that fit into the cannot require people to register their names?
Well, I would say that, if push comes to shove, an individual has the right to speak without registering their name. Now, that the sign-up sheet facilitates the orderly conduct of the meeting. And so, you know, but if someone really contested that, that could be an issue.
So if we say, please give your name and your address for the record, like we always do when someone approaches this podium, they could just say, nah, then that's fine?
Yeah.
Okay. That's I was today years old when I learned that. Okay.
So you can have reasonable rules of conduct, and they can be for both the council and the public. You have procedural rules, Robert's Rules of Order. I believe Mr. Crawford is your parliamentarian. I know a little bit to get me dangerous, but you know, try not to, you know, Robert's Rules was written for a really large body, and you guys seem to get your business done as long as they're designed to be fair and make a real clear record of what the decisions are. I think that's the guiding light for Robert's Rules. You can have limitations on public comment in terms of the length of time, speak only once, and limit it to certain issues. All public comments must be respectful. Well, we have that on the slide. I think it's a good guideline. But I attended this, it's probably been 7 or 8 years. Some jurisdictions were getting into situations where people were coming up and they were getting really aggressive, members of the public. And when it comes to members of the public, you can only really stop from someone from speaking when it becomes a disruption. You can guide them back to hey, these are our rules, you got to be respectful. But I always think about, well, what's the final act, or what's going to ultimately enforce someone if they're just up here and they're being nasty? You have to make a judgment. Is it being disruptive? The case law says it's when you disrupt a public meeting. If you're just being really aggressive, or if you're picking on a certain council member, that may not be sufficient. So I always recommend in those circumstances to take a recess. Let's evaluate it. If law enforcement is available, we try to get some de-escalation involved, and then we go from there. I kind of preempted myself. So these items, cameras and tape recorders, are allowed unless they are disruptive. And then here are the options that you have. Again, if you have a disruption, you can have the person removed, but I would recommend having a recess first. You can clear the room and continue the meeting. There's a process for that under the statute. Again, part of the statute is you can move the meeting to another location, but you have to have, it doesn't say this here, but you have to allow the media to attend. It does say that you have to allow the press to remain and allow non-disruptive individuals to be readmitted. But this is a really, a lot of jurisdictions have gotten into trouble over the years for going all the way to the point of having someone removed from a meeting when it was just unpleasant. There's a difference between unpleasant public testimony and disruptive public testimony. Executive session, we have these on occasion. They're limited to specific purposes, and the purpose is to be stated at the beginning. That occurs here. Confidentiality is required for executive sessions. It's a good reminder for all council members and staff. And we always recommend being precise about the purpose and the statutory exemption. Some common mistakes or misunderstandings. Personnel issues just all by itself, that's not an executive session category. There is a category for review of reviewing the performance of a public employee. And just any conference with an attorney is not an exemption. It has to be threatened litigation or potential litigation. But keep in mind, I don't use the term potential in this slide, but potential litigation is actually quite broad, because if you're assessing the risks of a course of action, that qualifies as potential litigation. Discussing an interlocal agreement or a negotiation strategy is not an executive session item. And interviewing potential council candidates, you can do the evaluation in executive session, but you can't do the interview of, for example, candidates that maybe you're seeking to fill a vacancy. The most common executive session purposes, buying or selling real estate. However, if you are looking to sell or lease property, you actually have to talk about the factors ahead of time and really just focus on the price in executive session. Buying is a little bit broader because that implicates the city's interest in a specific site. And that can affect price, so you have a little bit more leeway with buying real estate. I won't go into the rest of these. Staff would be setting these up for executive session. You can review the performance, as I said, of existing employees and evaluate qualifications for those seeking public employment and meet with legal counsel on potential litigation. We go through this, you know, each time, but yeah, you have to have your attorney present if you're going to be talking about potential litigation. And the last bullet point is part of it. We try to go through an assessment, this public knowledge regarding the discussion likely to result in adverse legal or financial consequences to the agency. We talked about penalties for violation of the Public Records Act. For the OPMA, there's personal liability for council members, $500 first offense and $1,000 subsequent offenses. Again, there can be costs and attorney's fees tacked on. An action at a meeting can be declared null and void if, for example, there's a case where a decision was essentially made in executive session, I think it involved the city of Spokane, and the contract was deemed void because there was never a public vote on it. Another example of that would be, and this brings to mind, let's say you want to do a letter. I've seen agencies get into trouble where they say, we're going to have counsel send a letter. And so they just pass around a letter, not in an open meeting, but they say, it isn't obviously an OPMA violation, but all of a sudden you have seven or a quorum of council members signing onto a letter. Well, you've basically made a decision without having a meeting. You've taken an affirmative position on something without having a meeting. So that's something that arguably is contrary to the OPMA. Minutes. Mr. Crawford takes care of those, I believe. I don't need to go into detail there. We've talked a little bit about this. I guess we're just emphasizing email exchanges can constitute a meeting. And part of the problem is it's such a clear record of what happened that it's easy for a plaintiff to prove their case, and, you know, by getting a hold of the documents. Open meeting frequently asked questions. Can you change the location? Yes, you can. In fact, I was part of a retreat where you had an open public meeting at another location. If you believe that there's been a violation of the executive session rules, just raise it and let's address it at that particular point in time and either clear it up, show why it is part of a category, or not continue with the executive session. Can you allow third parties into the executive session? Well, you can jeopardize the purpose of it. For example, if it's potential litigation, if you have some individual in there that is not part of the attorney-client privilege, you can jeopardize the purpose of the executive session, just like you can destroy the privilege by including a third party as part of the communication. And you can, as I talked about, you can give direction to the manager in the executive session without taking a formal vote. That is permitted. Okay, well, I'm gonna stop. This is bonus, and I have a sense that you don't want to go into the bonus section right now. How are we doing on time?
We're doing quite well on time. It's 5:30 right now. It'd be great if we could end around 5:50 so we can have
We don't actually start our main meeting till 6, so you do have some time here.
Okay. Governance and ethics. These questions have been coming up a lot in various jurisdictions, actually. And I'll just skip to what I think is the meat of it, but you have your city manager form of government. This isn't so much an ethics issue as seeing the different roles of the city manager versus the city council versus the mayor. You can read those on your own. I think those are going to be pretty self-explanatory, but if there are anyone wants to discuss anything along those lines, we can do that. Prohibition on gifts and lending of credit. So I've heard this body, I think, raise this question before. There's a constitutional provision in the state of Washington that you don't have in every state, which says that you cannot loan money or gift to anyone other than the support of the poor and infirm. By the way, it says poor and infirm, but it's really poor or infirm. Now, even though that's the stated prohibition for public agencies, there are lots of exemptions. And insofar as really what we're saying is there donative intent? So the test for gifting of public funds is there donative intent? And one of the key things that we'll be looking at is the city receiving some form of consideration for the payment of money. So what does that mean in the practical setting? Well, let's say some nonprofit says, I want $15,000 to run this program. Well, what should happen, there should be a council discussion that points out what is the city going to get that's within city powers as a result of the payment of that money. And then we will reduce that to writing and say, for providing these programs to the public, you're going to be paid this amount. And that, I think that's baked into city government here, such that that's how that would occur. But you have to ask the question, we're not just in the business of donating money to nonprofits. You have to look at what is the public benefit? What is the consideration? What are the specific deliverables that that nonprofit is going to give you for the payment of city money?
What about, this might be getting into the weeds, but what about if we have like a, let's say the visitor center has a thing where it brings a bunch of potential entrepreneurs into Blaine and gives them, you know, City of Blaine hats and City of Blaine coffee mugs and that kind of thing. I mean, this is swag, right? This is like, hey, remember Blaine? And, you know, just as kind of a thing, is where does that become property given the people that aren't infirmed? I mean, is that an okay thing?
Yeah, I have to go back to the, I do work with port districts, and port districts have a specific provision for promotional hosting. And that's what you're talking about, promotional hosting. I don't recall whether city government has that. I don't recall.
The state does.
The state does? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if it is, it's going to be in the state. There's usually economic development is something that kind of developed, not recently, but in later years after city governments were already underway. So if there is something that allows for that, it would be probably something you would see read from the powers of the city in terms of economic development and promotional hosting. I don't recall that off the top of my head, but that's a good thing to point out and to ask for. Okay, we need some clarification. Can we do this? Okay, here's the statutory citation, and let's put some parameters around it.
Actually, I have to clarify that. I'm speaking in terms of receiving items. I know that the state allows you to receive
right.
things of nominal value. It's the question of, is it a gift of public funds for the state to give it? That off the top of my head, I have to look into further. So
right.
what I just said.
And so an interesting point, and this might be here, is the state, now we're talking about receiving gifts as an elected official or an employee. The state has an interpretation where I think if it's $50 or less, it's not going to be deemed improper, assuming probably some other things. Local governments don't have that. They don't, if there's like a zero, there's no, as long as under a certain amount. So on the books, employees and elected officials at the local government level do not have that $50 threshold. But if you look at state, at the guidance on this, most people would say that if it is under that, the state auditor will not have a problem with it. So it presents a problem for attorneys because it's like you're looking at it, it's like, well, there's no $50 allowance here. But the reality is that there is some guidance that the state auditor probably will not have a problem with it, but you still got to be careful. You don't want to be having any sense that that's in exchange for anything, any sort of special favors or anything like that. And, you know, for example, I advise jurisdictions at the employee level, if someone brings in food, make it available to everyone in the office. Don't make it just to one individual. That way you're avoiding some of those perception issues and potential improper activity. Can't use public facilities for political purposes. That includes using staff time. That includes, there are cases where elected officials have gotten in front of the fire engine and using those images inappropriately. You guys are probably aware of some of those things. It's always good to check and make sure you're not going to have a problem with this particular prohibition. Exceptions to prohibitions on using, I'm not sure what that says, okay. So you do see jurisdictions like city council saying, we can take a position on a ballot measure, but you have to go through a specific process. That's what that's talking about. You can, the city council can say, you know, we're in favor of county proposition X, Y, and Z if you go through a specific process. That's an exception to using public facilities for political purposes. I would say that if you have people coming up in public comment and using that time to campaign, that's a problem. I would recommend saying, no, we don't allow that.
That's on a ballot measure, but not on an individual, correct?
Both.
That's on both. You could...
During a campaign for every public, hey, just so everyone knows I'm running for X, Y, and Z, I really appreciate your support. Here's my platform. That would be a problem.
No, I'm sorry. The council can only take an action on a ballot, yes. Not on a person.
Right, that's correct. Yeah, that's right. Conflict of interest issues. So there's a specific statute that talks about being beneficially interested in a contract, which is made under the supervision of that individual's office. And these can be tricky. There are exceptions for certain dollar thresholds. And there's also something called a remote interest. But let me start out by saying, this is a problem and it's not solved by recusal. So in the cases, there was the case that I'm thinking of involved a county commissioner who had a rock quarry, and there was a public works contract when the commissioner was elected, and the city was using that rock quarry as part of the public works contract. At the point the commissioner was elected, and this commissioner happened to be, this is back when they kind of divided up responsibilities and one was in charge of public works. This guy was in charge of public works, this commissioner. And at the point that he was elected, it wasn't a problem because the contract was already in place. The contract was not made under his supervision. But then there were some change orders approved that affected that contract. He tried to not be involved in it. He didn't vote, and in his sort of managerial role, he tried to have some subordinate deal with that contract. And the court said, no, you can't do that. It's still made under your supervision, and the contract just can't exist. You can't recuse yourself. Now, that's in contrast to, maybe back here we talk about remote interests. City of Raymond is that case that I was talking about. But there are some exceptions if low dollar thresholds in certain areas, but it's very specific, and there's a remote interest exception. I don't see that slide here. These are general conflict of interest issues. You can't use your position to secure special privileges or exemptions. And this applies to a municipal officer, which would obviously include all city council members. It would include the city manager. It would include the police chief. It may or may not include the finance director and the public works director, depending on the facts. Can't receive gifts or gratuities from any source. This is what I was talking about. Okay, so there's no $50 provision in here. It just says you can't receive a gift or gratuity or reward from any source except the employing municipality. It does say for a matter connected with or related to the officer's services, unless otherwise provided by law. Let's see the rest of those there. How are we doing on time? Here we go.
Just a few minutes left.
Okay. Oh, okay. So here's the remote. So this kind of going back to the interest in contracts. This is a situation where you still have to address the conflict. So now you have, let's go to number two, where let's say a council member is going to be voting on a contract, and that council member is an employee of a construction company that is going to be bidding on a public works award. If the council member in that context is an employee, then their compensation consists entirely of fixed wages or salaries, that's called a remote interest. And what that means is that the council member should not vote on the contract, They can't try to influence any of the other council members on the contract, and they have to disclose it, and it has to be noted in the official minutes of the meeting before there's a vote on the contract. Now that's in contrast, if you don't get into the remote interest section, because it's not remote, the contract can't exist. You can't, the council member would have to choose to give up. If the contract is gonna go forward, the council member would have to give up the seat or give up their ownership of whatever it was.
Madam Mayor, may I ask a question?
Please.
Peter, is that regardless if the contract is low bid? So the city may have to accept a higher bid if a council member had a pecuniary interest in the contract.
Yes, yeah, so that's correct. Although, but then you're going to get into trouble with bidding laws.
So we just rebid and exclude that bidder.
Yeah,
be an interesting scenario.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that one too. Because public bidding,
if that person had some ownership interest in the way you deal with that is say, look, you can't be bidding on these contracts because you're putting yourself in an ethical bind. Because presumably, we're talking about like an ownership interest or someone who's an employee, but they get bonuses.
Right.
See the tree he was barking up, I was thinking, well, if there's only one vendor in town or what, only one vendor of that type for 300 miles and there's a conflict that makes you say that contract can't happen, you know.
That's a problem in remote areas. And sometimes there might be, you know, there might be an exception for certain hospital districts where someone has said, you know, we can't get our work done, and they go to the legislature and they get an exception. Or you write the AG and you get some coverage. You write the AG's office and they write an AG opinion saying, we think you're good. You know, I've seen that happen before too. All right. So there are penalties for violating the Municipal Ethics Act, as indicated there, including the last one, possible forfeiture of office. There's a judicial doctrine of incompatible offices. The most obvious example of that is if one of you were tried to be the city manager at the same time as being on city council, that would be an incompatible office. There are others. Don't quote me on this, but there might be a problem if one of you were on like the school board. That would have to be analyzed under incompatible office.
I think the elections department snags that when you try and apply for it.
Well, let me tell you that just some observations, you know, try to spot these issues early. The risk is usually not worth whatever situation you might be headed towards. Focus on the perceptions. And that's true with Open Public Meetings Act as well. Focus on perceptions, because even if you have some technical defense, that isn't necessarily worth the political capital that you lose. Those are just general statements. I think we're pretty much there. Got a laundry list of ethical issues for you guys to read through. Oh, investigations for misconduct. I've been doing labor employment law for a number of years, and sometimes you get an allegation and the person being investigated, it is very difficult and it's very frustrating for the individual, but keep in mind that if this ever happens, it's for the protection of the individual as much as anything else, because you want to create a clear record of what happened. That's the key point on that one. Well, thank you for your attention and participation.
Okay, great. We're going to to stand down for a bit of a break and return for the proper city council meeting at 6 p.m.